This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Carlson Fish Oils. Fish oil provides the vital omega-3s, EPA and DHA, which support cardiovascular, brain and nerve, vision, immune system, joint, and skin health. Carlson ensures maximum freshness by managing their fish oils from sea to shelf. All Carlson fish oils are tested by an FDA-registered laboratory for freshness, potency, and purity, and they're available in soft gels and liquid form. For more information, go to carlsonlabs.com. Carlson fish oils are available at fine health food stores nationwide. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and once again, here we are. We're dearly beloved, we are gathered here together for yet another Q&A with Layla, wherein we answer your questions. Your questions can be sent to us via radio program at AOL.com. That's the destination for questions related to supplements, lifestyle, all manners of related to health. And again, a popular segment, part of what has pushed us over the 5 million download mark, which I'm very proud to share and announce with our listeners. Isn't that great, Layla?
That is amazing. Wow.
Yeah. So clearly, we have struck a chord among a wide audience of listeners. We really appreciate that you've come to rely upon us. You know, we know your time is valuable and that you should consecrate some of that on a weekly basis to our podcasts. We very much appreciate. So here we go. Let's take a look at some of the news this week. Of course, this week... Mm-hmm. We've been talking about the blood pressure guidelines. I think we covered that, and I will also cover that in a specific clinical focus podcast, talking about what the new blood pressure guidelines mean for you. And we'll talk a little bit about diet. We'll talk about lifestyle approaches to lowering blood pressure. Certainly, those are what we want to invoke before we pull the trigger on medication with all its side effects.
And Dr. Hoffman, just in response to your article about diagnosis creep, we've got a note here from Dorothy.
Yeah.
She said, thanks for the blood pressure article. That was really helpful. We work with people who want to dedicate themselves to diet and lifestyle change, learn to cook, etc. And this business of diagnosis creep is just outrageous.
Yeah.
Great article, and thank you.
And Dorothy, if I'm thinking of the right Dorothy, is a patient advocate. Who works with a lot of patients using natural conditions. She's a non-medical professional, but she really does a great job encouraging people
program.
To... The Suppers program in New Jersey. Dorothy runs that program. And, you know, certainly, you know, programs like hers enable people to, you know, provide them with hands-on information on how to implement a major lifestyle change. Focusing on a healthier diet, which really is the key to, I would say, the vast majority of blood pressure problems.
Yes.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Okay. So let's get directly into questions.
Okay.
What do we have in terms of questions this week?
Priscilla writes, Dear Layla and Dr. Hoffman, there is a study that purports to show that paleo diets and the like lower carb diets do not lower blood sugar. Can you comment? Now, I'll give you the information here that she sent us. They're asserting that high protein diets don't lower blood sugar. And this is an evidence-based medicine from 2013, also from Cell Reports from 2016, where it says, for the first time, a major article explains why high protein weight loss diets are far likely to prevent diabetes.
I contest that statement right away. I mean, I think somebody's come up with a bias, you know, like, oh, we're talking, let's go back to the DASH diet, like a very low meat, plant-based diet, and let's kind of like seek to demolish diets that include ample amounts of protein. So, you know, I contest that because diets that include ample amounts of protein are beneficial in diabetes, especially type 2 diabetes. But there is a caveat, and I think you're going to do a deep dive on that caveat.
Yeah,
high protein diets. Go ahead.
Well, first of all, when they describe low-carb diets like Atkins, Dukan, or Paleo, they mistakenly call them high-protein diets. They are indeed really not. The protein portion stays relatively the same, 20 to 30%. Low-carb diets are pretty much high-fat diets because the mistake...
Mm-hmm. And excuse me, and you know, I have to say that when I first heard Atkins talk about it, I was in the thrall of that low-fat paradigm in the 1980s, and I said, "Oh my God, he was Trump-like in a way in his utter contempt for the notion that fat was bad." And it was like, "Oh my God, how could he possibly say that you can eat as much fat as you want on my diet?" And it was like, "Really?" And he would say, "Yes, it's very important to eat a lot of fat." And you know, and we were all aghast, like, "Oh my goodness, you know, that's going to put the fat's going to clog the arteries of the people." And he's like, you know, people are going to drop like flies in his office. But
we all had to undergo, you know, we had to reverse the brainwashing even on ourselves. I remember back in the day when I read Dr. Atkins' New Diet Revolution.
And you worked there.
I did. It took me a couple of years to wrap my mind around the fact that the breakfast in front of me, the bacon and eggs portion, is not what's going to kill me. It's those potatoes and the juice and the toast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And any sugar that might have been in my coffee or something. Mm-hmm. So it's really... So what they've done, first of all, in this study, in what they're asserting here, is that a low-carb diet is high in protein. It is not, number one. So that's flaw right away in its description of what a low-carb diet is. The other thing they did was...
I might interject. A lot of people, you know, I'm on the paleo diet. So a lot of people say, "Oh my goodness, you're eating like tons of meat on that diet, aren't you?" And the answer is I'm eating ample meat. For example, I had a grass-fed T-bone steak last night, but that's a treat. I'm eating so many vegetables. Often when I have animal protein, it's in combination with vegetables. Like for lunch today, I had a clam chowder, Manhattan clam chowder soup that I made, which has, it's got some protein in the form of, I put some clams in there, and I put some cod in there to make it, you know, more of a fish chowder. And then there were a lot of potatoes and tomatoes and carrots and celery and onions. And so in effect, I had a vegetable stew that was with, you know, flavored with some protein. And since being on the paleo diet, I have to say I eat more vegetables than
more
ever.
More vegetables.
Before. Because I put away the toaster. Produce. I mean, I have no choice. You know, when I don't eat bread, bagels and things like that, even gluten-free stuff, you've got to be imaginative with vegetables to, you know, just to fill you up.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
so in this study...
To your point.
Yeah, in this study, 34 obese, non-diabetic women, 50 to 65 years old, were assigned to three groups. Listen to this, Dr. Hoffman. The first group, they were on a weight loss diet with a moderate daily protein intake, regular to, you know, 0.8 grams per kilogram of body weight, which is the standard recommendation. The high protein group was given a weight loss diet with 50% extra protein.
Oh my goodness. Boy.
And then the third group was a control group. Mm-hmm. So what do you think happened? And this is why a low-carb diet is not a high-protein diet.
Yep.
Any excess protein will be converted to blood sugar.
Right.
Therefore, it will not lower blood sugar. Mm-hmm. They did these low-carb diets wrong.
Right.
So this is a flaw in their methodology.
Right. So,
really.
So to give you an idea, I mean, you will get conversion from the certain what are called... gluconeogenic amino acids that are easily converted by the liver into glucose. They're called gluconeogenic amino acids, and I believe they are. Which ones are they? Glycine.
There are many.
Okay.
Yeah. There are branched chain amino acids. There are various amino acids, the essential amino acids. But the point is that gluconeogenesis is happening with the excess protein that the body is not going to normally burn.
Right.
For its metabolism.
And you know, that's my... I just got a pitch from Dr. Agatston, you know, with the Scarsdale diet.
The South Beach diet.
The Scarsdale diet is the one who shot some, you know, his girlfriend or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. This is Arthur Agatson, and I give Arthur Agatson a lot of credit because he's the guy who came up with the calcium scoring. Interesting enough, it's called an Agatson score when you do an EVG heart scan. And then he took his shot at being a diet doctor. And what he did is he looked at the Atkins diet. He said, well, that's all well and good, but there's too much fat in it. Let me cut the fat. And it's a high protein, low carb diet. And that I don't agree with. And I think he missed the point. And somehow he was sort of trying to triangulate between the people who were opponents of high fat diet and the new knowledge about low carb dieting benefits, and wrote a very successful book. But I actually don't think, I think that book precisely embodies this phenomenon, which is that it's not the most effective diet for blood sugar control.
No, not at all. Not at all. So a high protein diet in this fashion, because it also causes, because of gluconeogenesis, it's converting to blood sugar, and that blood sugar, any excess of it actually, is being stored as fat.
This, you know, how many grams of protein each participant in the study got on average? Because they added 50 grams.
Yeah, they don't say. They said 50% extra protein.
Oh, extra. So that could be like well over 100, you know.
It could be, yeah. And so,
I mean, maybe for a bodybuilder, a very active person, a large-bodied person, that might be you know, not a bad idea, because you are, you know, when you're doing weightlifting, strength training, that's there's a lot of protein demands. But for the average person, you know, it's not,
But in this study, and it was a small study, it was 34 obese women from 50 to 65. Yeah, these aren't the bodybuilders that we're talking about. So really, this study is bogus, honestly.
Yeah.
They did the low-carb diets wrong.
Yeah.
They made them high in protein rather than high in fat, which is what they truly are. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, and I it's interesting. I looked at U.S. News and World Reports, which is, I don't know, it's not even a really much of an entity anymore. It used to be a magazine, and now they basically do ratings, kind of like Consumer Reports. And so they came out with the best and worst diets. And for, you know, the seventh year in a row, the DASH diet was considered the ultimate diet, and which is a diet which is very low in fat. As you know, it's a lot skim or very low fat or no fat dairy. And
lots of whole grains.
Lots of whole grains. You know, 6 to 12 servings per day. Lots of fresh fruits and vegetables. Too many fruits, and it's too permissive of carbohydrates. But nonetheless, I mean, it's better than the standard American diet, and some people benefit from it. But what they rated as the very last, the very worst diet, was the Paleo diet.
Oh, you're kidding!
The very worst, which is comes from a complete misunderstanding. And of course, the second worst was the Atkins diet. So even more notorious than the Atkins diet was Paleo diet. But yes, okay, if your perspective is that fat is bad and dangerous, you're going to rate those diets lower, you know, because those diets are intentionally ample fat.
I don't think fat phobia, at least in food, you know, in the food political science industry, is going to go away anytime soon.
Yep. It's very
entrenched. And the continued assertion that vegetable oils are healthy and all of that, it's unfortunate.
Yeah.
So Priscilla, thank you for this question. If they had done these diets properly in this experiment, they would have gotten a different result, because Atkins, Dukan, Paleo, they're not high protein diets. They're higher in fat, particularly Atkins and Dukan. Paleo can vary a bit. But so we would not expect blood sugar levels to go down on any high protein diet because of that conversion that we discussed. Yeah. Okay. So we have a question. We have an email from Eileen. Good morning. How much water should I be drinking? I eat a very clean diet every day. I have for a long time. I eat lots of produce, fruits and vegetables, organic. I don't eat any added sugar or drink alcohol. I do take a number of supplements. Now, my main problem is that I have trouble with very hard stools every day. I've tried to eliminate supplements to try and find out if one of them is the offender. Doesn't seem to be the problem, and now I'm thinking I don't drink enough liquid every day. Dr. Hoffman, get a load of this. Mm-hmm. Eileen has 2 cups of coffee every day, mm-hmm. a whey protein shake with a cup of almond milk, mm-hmm. and then followed by 20, maybe 30 ounces of water for the rest of the day. Mm. Is that a sufficient amount of liquid to consume each day? No. No. Mm-hmm. So Eileen, and she writes, thank you in advance for your help. I thoroughly enjoy your column each week and look forward to it. Eileen, you need to up the amount of water you're drinking. And for mm-hmm. every cup mm-hmm. of high test, meaning caffeinated coffee you're having, you have to add an additional cup of water. 8 8-ounce cups or 6 8-ounce cups of water minimum is actually the best idea. The other thing that you could do, Eileen, is take your weight. This could be a good rule of thumb for most people who are in the reasonable weight category. Take your weight, divide it in half, and convert it to ounces. So for a 120-pound woman, cut it in half, 60. 60 ounces of water a day is about right. So 20 to 30 ounces, you're not getting sufficient water. Anybody would be constipated. And another thing that occurs to me, Eileen, if you're taking any calcium turns the stool into concrete.
Yep.
And then you add the insult of not taking in enough water, then forget about it. Nobody's going to the bathroom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I have to say that there may be an element of confirmation bias in your answer, which is something that we have to be wary of as clinicians. Like a patient will say, I think I have candida. I've got all mm-hmm. the symptoms of candida. I've got this, I've got it, that, I've got the other thing. And I'm trying to treat my candida, so what can I do to treat my candida? By analogy, this is a person who's concluded that the water intake is the source of her constipation, which it well might be. It well might
yeah.
be. I mean, that's a reasonable conclusion. But I would have to open the lens further to other potential causes of constipation.
Sure.
So, you know, when there are cognitive biases that sometimes trip us up, and you could actually look this up. This is something that people study in
confirmation
logic
bias?
And logic oh, yeah. and philosophy classes, you know, mm-hmm. ways of that the mind tends to kind of skip to conclusions without drawing back and looking at it from
right,
you know, from
meaning
a high altitude.
Wanting to confirm their supposition of what is actually happening.
Yeah.
That is confirmation bias. Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
So, mm-hmm. or we could have projection bias. You know, like a person comes in and says, you know, I've got a terrible pain on my right side mm-hmm. Under my rib cage, and the doctor goes, oh, you know, I just had my gallbladder out. You know, it's exactly the same thing that happened to me. I think you have a gallbladder. Well, okay, you might, but you could also have an ulcer. You know, you could have an. I mean, there's
sure.
various forms. So without going astray, and this is a digression, you know, she's taking whey powder. Mm-hmm. The suggestion is, you know, maybe get away from powders, which are obviously low in fiber, and eat more in the way of fresh and real food. And also
yes.
consider the microbiome. Consider taking probiotics, which do have often a yeah. beneficial effect on constipation.
Yeah.
You know, or things like, you know, FOS, mm-hmm. these can help, fructose oligosaccharides.
Yes. Some people wind up taking heroic amounts of fiber to find that their constipation is not alleviated. And lo and behold, when they take a good quality probiotic, everything is better. Mm-hmm. Bowel movements become more normal. Prebiotics as well.
Yeah.
Such as Flowey. Now, Eileen does say that she eats a very large amount of fruits and vegetables, but again,
yeah.
how much is that actually? That's mm-hmm. what she says. How much is yeah. that actually? Yeah.
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 And, you know, there are such things as motility problems, and they could even be related to such problems as hypothyroidism, which is really common in women. So, you know, a slowdown in motility could be an issue too. And there are certain pro-motility herbs, and certainly, you know, addressing thyroid problems could be part of it. All right.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Okay. So, Eileen, up your water intake and see what happens. Thank you for your question.
Okay.
All right.
We're going to pause because we divide our podcast into two parts. Give us a preview of what we're going to be talking about in part two.
Oh, can swallowing cold air while running in the winter cause bronchial irritation or bronchitis?
I don't know about swallowing, but breathing, yeah. Okay.
Breathing, sure. Yeah.
Okay. We'll return. We'll answer that question and others, and we'll remind you that you can email your questions to radioprogram@AOL.com. That's radioprogram, one word, at AOL.com. And it'll be a week or two because we're a little backlogged, but we'll get around to answering your questions if you keep listening to our weekly Q&A with Layla, as we hope you do. We'll be back in just a moment.